Several local races are headed to a May runoff election here in Jacksonville. This morning, we kick off our conversations with the candidates. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we speak with City Council candidate Lisa King. What are your questions for her? Give us a call right now. It's 549-2937. Then later, a new film that shares a compelling First Coast story about the life-saving gift of organ donation. Plus, The Spectator will be along with her top five picks for your weekend. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, several local races are headed to a runoff election in May. We are profiling the Jacksonville City Council at-large races this spring on the show as we host the candidates that will be asking for your vote in the runoff. We're kicking things off this morning with Lisa King, the Democratic candidate for Jacksonville City Council at-large Group 1. She joins us now in studio, and she's already getting your calls. Lisa King, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Thanks for being with us. Now, we have reached out to all four at-large candidates in the May runoff. We'll have Tommy Hazuri this week. We are scheduling his opponent, Greg Rachel, and King's opponent, Terrence Freeman, as soon as we can get them on the show. And we want your calls right now. What are your questions for candidate Lisa King? It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. And we always welcome your thoughts on Facebook as well. All right, Lisa King, you're well-known in the community, former leader of the local Democratic Party, small business leader, were on the city's planning commission, among other roles. You're going to a runoff in May against Republican Terrence Freeman, certain to be a low turnout runoff election. And so as you go about this campaign, the final stretches of this, what's your message to the voters? Why should they choose you over your opponent?
Well, I'm a native of Jacksonville. I have broad experience and have lived all over the city and a love for this city, a record of service. Public service to our community through nonprofit boards, as well as a point of office at the city. Professionally, I work with cities and counties, so I know more about how cities and counties work and best practices that have worked in other parts of our state. And I'm very excited about bringing that opportunity to Jacksonville. So I want to bring an independent voice and bring to bear on the issues that citizens tell me all the time are most important to them, and that is the issues of our crime rate, particularly our violent crime rate, and providing better opportunities for jobs that lead to careers for our kids and grandkids, and also making sure that the JEA stays a public utility.
Why would you be better positioned than your opponent, Mr. Freeman, to accomplish those goals?
Well, I think my experience brings me from a different place that I can provide solutions that may be have been tried in other parts of our state, and a point of view that's quite different than his. As well as, I think that I bring an independent voice.
Independent how?
Well, there are some folks that say that Mayor is supporting Mr. Freeman and not me. I think it's been very clear that that's the case. And I believe that the mayor's point of view is certainly valued, but that the best policy is made when we bring a lot of voices to the table with very different points of view. We ask hard questions. We examine those. We talk to the public. We talk to the voters and come to a solution that way, rather than kind of a top-down, my way or the highway point of view.
If you win this runoff, Mayor Curry would be denied a 13-vote supermajority, let's say, on the city council, a block of council reps out of that 19-member body that he could reliably depend on to vote mostly his way. Is that part of your message, that that you would provide a counterweight to the mayor's administration and their priorities?
Well, you know, that's the kind of issue that probably people who are your listeners are very aware of. Most voters they're not into the inside baseball of city council, and I'm not really interested in making this a choose me if you don't like Mayor Curry kind of a thing. I'm really more interested in finding solutions that work for everyone and working with the mayor. I just don't want to work for him.
It's 549-2937 to speak to at-large group one city council candidate Lisa King. Okay, you were on, as you mentioned, the planning commission, the Jacksonville Planning Commission from 2012 to 2015. You were chair of that commission for a while. You were one of several prominent local Democrats that Mayor Curry kicked off boards and commissions when he became mayor. And so that had, I think, the perverse effect of increasing your name recognition in some respects, because there was a lot publicized about that.
Yes.
There's been a lot of partisan rancor, I think, around some of these actions, and it's carried over into some of these local races. Mm-hmm. You're running as a Democrat in a still slightly right-leaning county. So in a citywide race, many people will vote just based on their partisan affiliation. What's your message to independents and Republicans that will, you know, probably decide these contests, these at-large contests?
Well, my message doesn't change no matter who I talk to. I mean, the issues are crime, jobs, and the JEA. I'm very proud that I was endorsed by Police and Fire in this race. They agree with me that we can't police our way out of this crime problem, that we need to provide resources to families in crisis, and we need to bring that focus in order to try to get a handle on this problem. I'm like many, and I've heard a Republican candidate talk about this as well. My son separated from active duty Navy. He's a naval officer and engineer, and went on his big job search. This is a Navy town, and guess what? No job in Jacksonville could touch the offer that he got from a company in Tampa. And the crazy part is he's not even working in engineering. He's working in financial services, which I thought we were a leader in. And the fact that someone like my son, who's a Stanton graduate, a UF graduate, this is the kind of person that we want to keep here, and that we are not attracting yet the kinds of jobs that we can guarantee that our young people are going to come back to Jacksonville. I can't tell you the number of his classmates at Stanton who are spread out all over the United States and not back here in Jacksonville. That kind of brain drain needs to stop. And, you know, again, speaking to MPAs, Republicans, and Democrats, 75% of our citizens believe that JEA should stay a public utility, or at the very least, the decision should be theirs if it becomes anything but that.
Are you concerned that an effort could start up again to perhaps privatize JEA? Do you see the city council as a backstop to that?
Ultimately, it will be the citizens' decision. I doubt that it's something will come that will be a wholesale sale. I mean, that failed miserably last year. But selling off pieces, particularly under that 10% kind of benchmark of when we would have to go to the public, yeah, absolutely. The council, that will be in the council's decision. And so having someone at the table who, you know, frankly, I organized the JEA is Ours campaign last year, who comes with that mindset of understanding the value of that utility to our community for so many different reasons that it is important to have that kind of voice on council.
How significant do you think the JEA is Ours campaign was, which you did lead and create, in stopping the push to privatize the utility?
Well, As you know, that camp, the effort to sell JEA seemingly came out of nowhere and moved so faster than we kind of expected it to. And so I think making sure that the public was aware that this move was afoot was critical in stopping that. And, you know, I think there was a major miscalculation on how the public felt about our utility. Particularly, I think, because of the role it had just played in hurricane recovery and the stories we heard from other parts of the state where people were weeks without power. People saw the value of having a local utility that was accountable to the people and getting power restored as quickly as possible.
Lots of calls for Lisa King as she heads to a May runoff against Terrence Freeman in the City Council at-large Group 1 race. This is the first of the conversations we're holding with candidates that are going to a May runoff. We hope to book Lisa King's opponent, Terrence Freeman, in the coming weeks. And we're hosting as many of the other candidates as we are able to before the May election. And we are now taking your calls, too. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Jim in Riverside. Hey, Jim. Good morning to you.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. My question for the candidate is, as you've mentioned already, that she was elected by the Planning Commission as the chair, and when Mayor Curry came in office, he removed her from that position in favor of his political appointee. And I would like to ask if Lisa King is elected into council, will she serve as a check against the mayor and his declared mission to turn downtown into rubble?
Whoa. Okay. Of course, Mayor Curry would not agree with that. He'd say we want to rebuild on some of these sites where buildings are coming down. But what about that question?
Well, something we didn't touch on here is while I advise cities and counties on how to secure grants from the federal and state government, and that's a major part of my business. Also part of my business is downtown development. My company did the W.A. Knight building in Jacksonville's downtown. And if you've been to the Volstead, you've been in the W.A. Knight. And we've done projects in other communities in Florida. I used to live in Riverside. I was chair of Riverside Avondale Preservation in the 90s, and I value our historic buildings. And I think that one of the greatest strengths our downtown has, in addition to its location on the water, on the river, is the fact that we have the largest inventory of historic buildings of any downtown in Florida. And so any move to tear down historic buildings, I come at from a position of very great concern, because if we've just value new construction, our downtown's not going to look different than anybody else's. And so why would anyone, it would not be a draw, it would not be an incentive, it would not have the kind of vibrancy and flavor that we all want in our downtown and that we know it needs to be successful. So, and important to remember is that, you know, some people come at this as, you know, that building's ugly, right? Well, there are so many buildings that used to be in our downtown that in the 60s, people regarded as ugly that now we really wish we still had. And so, and I certainly remember when the Hayden Burns Library, there was a big effort to tear that down. I was very involved and vocal in the don't tear down the Hayden Burns Library. I think we can all agree that it's an asset in our downtown now. And
now
so
the Jesse Ball DuPont Center.
Yes. So I worry that we are continuing to go down that path, particularly with our mid-century architecture downtown.
Do you think the Jacksonville Landing should be repurposed rather than torn down?
I think that's certainly a conversation that we need to have. You know, I'm somewhat cynical about the approach that's going to be taken, largely because we know that Metro Park is going to have to be replaced. Metro Park was acquired partially with federal funding in the 70s. And so the feds are going to require for us to replace that park space.
And do you think that's why there's a push to turn the landing into park space? It makes it easier to get for the city to get hold of Metro Park and develop it?
Yes. And again, that's kind of a cynical point of view, but, I'm always in favor of mixed-use development because I do believe that brings more vibrancy to a community. The core of our downtown, the Lower Street Corridor, is right on the tipping point of about to explode because the Barnett is, you know, close to being open. There's movement on the Lower Street Trio. It would be a shame to totally remove the landing. I totally agree that the way it's designed right now, it kind of turns this back to downtown, mm-hmm. and we need to open at least the center of it, but so that it invites the river into all of our downtown. But there's been so many conversations about what it could be repurposed for. A food hall is one. In some ways, it feels, you know, structurally a bit like the Pike Place Market in Seattle. And so there are so many things that we can do. But again, my style is not one of this is what we should do, top-down decision-making. My style is let's invite the community in to have a conversation and develop some consensus. It is unusual in most downtown buildings in that we own it. Right? The city owns it. We own the land. We own the building. And so it is our decision to make, not the private sector's.
Do you feel the city council has already moved too far down the path on this for the public to have a say?
Well, they have voted and funded demolition. So, it appears that the train is leaving the station. But we know there have been other times when the public has cared and made their voices heard where the city's changed direction. And, you know, so that could still happen.
Lots of calls, meanwhile, for Lisa King going into a May runoff against Terrence Freeman in the City Council at-large Group 1 race. Edward in San Marco. Hi, Edward. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for having me. As a longtime Democrat, my question is for Lisa. How can we trust your leadership after, as the head of the Democratic Party, we had 4 city council seats unopposed by Democrats and no Democrat running for mayor, which led to the worst Democratic turnout in years in Jacksonville?
Edward, thanks for that question. All right, you were the leader of the local Democratic Party, and you have taken criticism for not mm-hmm. having a D on the ballot to run against Mayor Curry. And the local party didn't field strong Democratic candidates, as Edward mentioned, in a number of other contests. How do you respond to criticism from Democrats that, especially given the fact that Andrew Gillum, the candidate for governor, won Duval County mm-hmm. last November, that there was momentum on the blue side of the political ledger and that the local party should have done a better job of capitalizing on that?
Well, first of all, most of our candidates for mayor, frankly, self-recruit. If you are going to put yourself out there into that kind of race, you're an ambitious person who wants to make change, and you're not going to wait to be invited, number one. Number two, we did speak to many people about considering a run for mayor. I'm no party leader is in the position to make somebody do something they don't want to do or prevent somebody from doing something that they want to do. Most of the folks that we spoke to were not interested, frankly, because of the amount of money that Mayor Curry already had in the bank. And, there's a lot of folks in this town who look at things, play the long game. And for them, it made more sense to wait 4 years. Defeating an incumbent mayor is a very, very difficult task. This race was much like Mayor Payton's reelect in 2007. There was a Democrat in that race. It was an activist. It was someone who frankly didn't have the ability to raise money. So any Democrat would not have generated more turnout because the turnout in that race in 2007 was 19%. Also important to remember is that turnout in municipal elections is always bad. And if you look at other communities in Florida in the same time frame, Tampa has an open mayoral race and 5 candidates. Their turnout was 19%. So ours is 25. I mean, we actually did better. And Gainesville, one would think that they would have really high voter turnout in Gainesville just because the educational levels of the majority of their citizens, their turnout for their mayor's race was 13%. So we did make efforts to recruit a candidate, but, you know, I can't make anybody run. Yes, there were some seats where we did not recruit candidates for council. The majority of those seats were overwhelmingly Republican performing districts. It's difficult to recruit someone to run for a race that they know the odds are very, very difficult or against incumbents. you know, yes, we did have incentive coming, we did have momentum coming out of November, but the fact is, very few people thought Duval was going to perform like it did in November. And that race was, frankly, not really over for us until after Thanksgiving because of the recount.
That's true. All of that said, though, you know, I've gotten a lot of feedback from local Democrats about not just the mayor's race, but this issue more broadly. Their perspective seems to be that this region of the state is slowly but surely trending more blue. And they don't feel that the party that they're affiliated with, the Democratic Party, whether it's in Jacksonville or somewhere else in Florida, is doing an adequate job of the sort of blocking and tackling and work on the ground to build the kind of strong framework, the kind of apparatus that would make the Democratic Party more competitive in this state, not just here, but statewide. They're very critical of their own party leadership.
Yeah.
And so what do you think as a perhaps one of the most high profile Democrats in Jacksonville, what's the party's response to that criticism?
Well, you know, the Duval County Democratic Executive Committee is a volunteer organization. We raise resources ourselves to try to turn out Democrats. The task as you've laid out, which I accept as a task and a goal of the DEC, is very, very difficult to do with that kind of level of resources. When we've been successful here, when you see the trending in the 2016 election and the 2018 election, a lot of that is demographic, but it is also because of outside organizations that come and help with a heavy lift. So if they're not going to be invested in our municipal election as well, it's difficult to make that heavy lift. And in order to move the needle over time, it has to be consistent investment. I don't know if we, and let me remind our listeners, there were two women who had filed to run for mayor as Democrats, okay? Neither of them ultimately qualified. Part of the challenge as party leaders is that our hands are somewhat tied when there are already candidates in a race. And we could equally be criticized with like, oh, you've disrespected these two women who've already put themselves out there by finding some other candidate. Party leadership is you can't do anything right and you can't make everybody happy. Not that we try.
Lots of calls for Lisa King, 549-2937. Susan is in Mandarin. Hi, Susan. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I loved what Lisa King said about JEA, but my question was about the resiliency pledge. I was handing out flyers to people, letting them know which candidates had signed the resiliency pledge. And a couple of people said to me, are they Democrats or Republicans? And I thought that was odd. And I just wonder if this whole thing, especially with a caller saying, we're so partisan with Democrat and Republican. Are we really researching what each candidate has to say? If people are just voting based on Democrat or Republican, is that really good for our country? I have more questions, but I guess I'll leave it there. Thank you very much for having Lisa King on.
Thank you, Susan. Yes, and this is a question, thanks for reminding me, Susan, that we will ask all of the runoff candidates. The resiliency pledge has been generated in this local election cycle. Do you support it?
Yes, I've signed the resiliency pledge, and my opponent has not. I am a riverfront homeowner. I live on Heckscher Drive. The dredge is actually right in front of my house right now. And I have been jolted awake several times when I know that they are dynamiting the bottom. And because I am a riverfront homeowner, I am probably more in touch with how the river responds to extreme weather than many people. Now, because of where I live, very much north near the mouth of the river, where most of the riverbanks have not been bulkheaded, where there, because of the our wonderful investment in ourselves in the Timucuan Preserve by Charlie Bennett's leadership, there are, you know, acres and acres and acres of marsh that are protected that act as a giant sponge for when we have these extreme water events, as well as filters that clean our water, as well as nurseries for sea life. And so, you know, while I have seen the impacts, I didn't have to deal with what people in deep in our urban core had to as a result of Hurricane Irma. And we can't unsee that. And we can't pretend like that was just one of those things and it's never going to happen again. We saw flooding during Matthew as well. And so as someone who is a native here, who's someone, you know, I'm a grandmother, I have another grandbaby on the way, I worry about the future of our community. And we have to make hard decisions and make plans for things that are going to cost us now and that we will largely never see the impact of, but future generations will. And, you know, unfortunately, I think the city has only taken on the task of resiliency because the state has made them.
The state mandate to start this working group on flooding that is now meeting.
Yes.
So what more should city leadership, do you think, be doing?
Well, the first thing we should be doing is we should undertake, even if it's on our own dime, a phase two storm surge study for the impacts of the dredge. Okay, so other communities in other parts of the country, like Charleston, for example, the Army Corps paid for that kind of study, and it informed mitigation that they were going to have to do. Because our dredge was undertaken under an executive order that President Obama put in place called We Just Can't Wait, to kind of jumpstart capital investment. And it was partially in response to the recession. The Army Corps was able to skip that step. It is just irresponsible for us to continue to undertake the dredge without that information so that we can plan for what we need to do to mitigate for those impacts, because those impacts are coming. And we know that whatever you believe sea level rise is happening, it is happening. And Jacksonville is actually a hot spot for sea level rise. So we're going to see more and more of these. We know we're in a cycle where our weather is becoming more and more extreme, and we must plan for those. So we must do that storm surge study. We must identify what mitigation needs to take place. We need to take steps to program, to find the funds to implement those. And I actually, because of my professional background, have some insights and some funding that you can get for that. But program it to a CIP and make it a priority. Right now, I'm just seeing as frankly, we're doing as little as we can get away with and just by what's required from the state. And it's just not good enough.
A few more calls for Lisa King. Tom on the West Side. Go ahead, Tom. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning. My question is this. I was wanting to know if Ms. King supported moving the public comment back to the earlier time rather than the very end of the session, which denies the people the right to be heard, pardon me, by the media, and really tilts the balance in favor of the administration.
You mean at city council meetings, the public comment period, Tom?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Thanks for that.
Thanks for that question, Tom. Yeah, I do. You know, as somebody, again, who served on the Planning Commission for 3.5 years, we often would hear, we would hold public hearings on zoning exceptions and land use changes and such. And so we would have hours of public comment. And, you know, often this public comment was repetitive, very frankly. But the fact is, for a citizen to be concerned enough about an issue to find out when a meeting is going to be, come downtown, pay to park, wait for a long time, it is our duty to hear them and to listen attentively, even if we think we know what the person's going to say because they're, you know, someone who comes frequently, or we think we know they're going to repeat what the last person just had to say. for government to work, the citizens need to feel that they are part of the decision making and that they are heard. That is our job, is to listen. And, you know, that's the spirit that I want to bring to council.
And again, as we said at the top of the hour, you're going to be asked to vote again, Duval, on these at-large city council races. There are several of them that have gone to May. Lisa King, a Democrat, will face Terrence Freeman, a Republican, in the at-large Group 1 race. We're working to book Mr. Freeman on this show as well, along with several of the other candidates on the May ballot. And I say this all the time, but don't neglect to go out and vote, because these races are important. Go to DuvalElections.com or go to our website at WJCT.org to learn more about these candidates and these races. Lisa King, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
Much more still ahead. Later, The Spectator with a few ideas for your weekend. It's her top five. But up next, a new film that captures a compelling local story. One you won't believe, actually. It's right after this here on First Coast Connect. We'll be right back.
UNF is hosting its annual Introduce a Girl to Engineering Day on April 13th. Children grades 3 through 5 are invited to this fun, hands-on workshop to learn about engineering. Event is open to the public. More information at unf.edu/CAWE.
First Coast Home Pros has teams of specialists to clean your home inside and out, including pressure washing, window cleaning, and gutter cleaning. More at firstcoasthomepros.com. Our goal is to be the best service company you've ever invited into your home. Get ready to explore the outdoors on International Migratory Bird Day at the Temuquan Ecological and Historic Preserve, Saturday, April 13th at 10 a.m. Join us for a great day exploring the outdoors and learning how to preserve and protect the habitat that migrating birds rely on and many birds call home. This fun, free family event is hosted by WJCT, the Temuquan Ecological and Historic Preserve, Temuquan Park Foundation, and Florida Park Service. To learn more, go to wjct.org/events.
To protect coastal cities from rising sea levels, you should hear what they're doing in Rotterdam.
The Dutch know what they're doing because they've been measuring the sea level for the longest.
And Nina Khrushcheva explains Putin's Russia.
Russia continues to understand itself in imperial terms. As all empires, they do think that they should be the most important ones in the world.
It's on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Saturday morning at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, this is a really moving story that captures the parallel lives and an amazing bond between two people who really impacted each other, but they never actually met. The movie Two Hearts tells the story of Jorge and Leslie Bacardi and a man named Christopher Gregory. Christopher was Jorge's organ donor. Now, Jorge Bacardi is from the famed Bacardi rum and spirits family. Everyone knows that name, right? But what you might not know is that Jorge had suffered since childhood with a debilitating lung disease that nearly killed him. A double lung transplant at Mayo Clinic here in Florida in 2008 helped Jorge take his first full breath of air at the age of 64. His donor was Christopher Mark Gregory, a young man who died at age 19. But his gift of organ donation helped Jorge get that life-changing transplant. Now, April is National Donate Life Month, and to raise awareness about the importance of organ donation, Gabriel House of Care is hosting a movie premiere. It's the premiere of Two Hearts and this incredible story. Here with Now, we welcome Valerie Callahan, Executive Director, Gabriel House of Care. Good morning.
Good morning.
And on the line, Lance Houle. He's the producer of the Two Hearts film. Lance, good to have you.
Good morning.
And in a moment, we'll hear all about the movie premiere. But first, Gabriel, House of Care, of course, has a strong connection to Jorge Bacardi. Mm-hmm. So you decided to bring awareness to this, Valerie, through telling Jorge's story on film and having a premiere in Jacksonville. How did this come about?
Yeah, it was really different. It's not something our small nonprofit would have pulled together, but Leslie and Jorge asked Lance, who's the director and producer, and Conrad Houle, if they would consider doing the premiere here. They did one, a private showing in L.A. They agreed upon it. And so Leslie called me in January and said, can you pull it together? So we did, and it's been tremendous. It does focus. It's a very inspiring story.
And this is premiering Saturday at the Downtown Library. Mm-hmm. Lance, tell us a little bit more about the movie, Two Hearts.
Well, it's a very heartfelt movie. It's, you know, one always is careful with true stories as you're making them because you want to be you want to be true to that, but at the same time, you want to engage the audience. And so very carefully, we weave this story and direct it in such a way that it is, you know, for first of all, it's for all audiences, and it has a Dove rating of endorsement, which Dove is a organization that looks at movies and then says whether they, you know, Christian families and should see the movie, and this one has been approved. And so we were very careful as to what we told and what we didn't tell. And I think that the result is something that everybody will enjoy. It is, has ups and downs and a little bit of comedy, but it's a beautifully shot movie. We went into locations in Hawaii and in Vancouver. It's a big, beautiful movie to look at. The music is fantastic. The acting is phenomenal. So it's a A-plus Hollywood movie.
This isn't a documentary, Valerie. Mm-hmm. Actors portray these roles.
The movie is a depiction from the book that was written by Christopher's father, All My Tomorrows, which is a nonfiction. That is the true story of the transplant in Jorge's life, in Christopher's life. What Lance and Conrad and the Houles did, and Veronica, who's a screenplay writer, was create like a parallel Hollywood version. For many reasons that we appreciate. So it's not exactly the book, which you wouldn't want it to be because you could never get through it. It's heartbreaking because one dies and one lives, right?
How did Christopher die?
He had a brain aneurysm.
Very
quickly.
So, but he wanted to be an organ donor,
yes,
in case anything happened to him. And that's the whole point of Donate Life Month.
That's right.
So that people understand if you signify you want to be an organ donor, yeah, you make your intentions clear, it can make an incredible difference for someone else.
What he did at the age of 16 when he got his driver's license, he just marked, everyone would want my body parts, right? In jest, not recognizing the ramifications of that. So, yes, this is Donate Life Month, and we want everyone to understand that when you check the box, it has phenomenal consequences.
So Christopher dies at the age of 19.
Mm-hmm.
His lungs are made available to Jorge Bacardi.
Mm-hmm.
As we mentioned, he has a famous last name.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone knows Bacardi Rum. But despite all his privileges, he couldn't breathe well. He had a lung disability. So how did this lung transplant change his life?
So from the time of birth, he had a very rare lung disease. So his whole life was complicated by illness. When he was transplanted, what happens with lung transplant? I mean, he had a whole new set of young lungs. And so he was able to breathe. He was able to live. And that's what organ transplant does. But what none of us really understand is just because you get new organs doesn't mean the rest of your life is perfect. You're on 25 different medications. All that will compromise your immune system. And eventually, will, you know, help not let you live as long. But it gives you life for a period of time. Many transplant patients live 20 years or longer. But it isn't an easy path, and most of us don't recognize that about organ transplant.
Let me ask you as well, Lance. You're the producer of the Two Hearts film. It's exciting to have a local movie premiere here in Jacksonville because, as some people know, Florida has ended incentives for film production, and it's all gone up across the border to Georgia. And so talk a little bit, if you could, about what it's like for Jacksonville and Duval to host a movie premiere, telling a local story.
I think it's a privilege to have the Gabriel House and to have this movie come and support it. We actually have a studio in Santa Fe, New Mexico, that does give incentives. But, you know, you go to where you need to go for the story. And this story, revolves around a big city, revolves around the beautiful islands. And so it goes, you have to go where you can shoot close to what the reality is. So that's why we did it where we did it. But, Florida should definitely have incentives. I did a movie, Flipper, many years ago with Elijah Wood and Paul Hogan.
Oh, right.
We were going to shoot it in Florida, but we ended up going to the Bahamas. And, you know, we'd love to shoot more in Florida. We actually, I live in Key Largo, so it would be great for us to shoot in Florida.
Sure, that'd be more convenient for you. Mm-hmm. It's exciting. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, no, I think that it's short-sighted to think that all because we're giving fat cats in Hollywood money. That's not true. there's a whole huge industry of people that don't make all the noise that we hear from Hollywood. Mm-hmm. The reason we don't watch the Oscars anymore is because of those people. But the working people. They just normal people. So, you would help a lot and have a lot more people employed if you gave some incentives in Florida.
Yeah, and it's a clean industry, too.
And for Jacksonville.
Oh, absolutely.
And for, yeah. For us, too.
We don't pollute. We try to do is entertain and tell stories as magnificent as this, which really needs to be out there so people can realize that, as Valerie said, checking one box makes a lot of difference mm-hmm. to a lot of people. We in the film don't have time to tell everybody's story that Chris actually touched, but, you know, there were at least five other people that benefited.
Oh, his organs helped other people, too.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, but yeah. So that's important to note. So with all of that said, the premiere of Two Hearts is this Saturday, April 6th, at the Downtown Main Library. Only two other cities are getting a premiere, New York and L.A. How can people be part of this premiere, Valerie?
Well, we're sold out.
It's sold out.
Yeah, we're sold out. But what people can do is just call into the office, 904-821-8995, and get on a waiting list. Because you know how all of us, things change, some people fall out. So that's what I would tell you to do. The one thing I want to say, any time that any nonprofit or any company can do something like this for our city and let our city shine like this, it's so accolades, right? It's so great for our city to be shining. So that means a lot to us at Gabriel House.
It sure does. It's the premiere this Saturday of the Two Hearts movie. Valerie Callahan, Executive Director, Gabriel House of Care, producer of the film, Lance Houle, on the line from California. Lance, Valerie, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you for hosting us.
Now, that is a sold-out film this weekend, but we do have some ideas for what you might get up to on Saturday and Sunday with The Spectator, and a conversation with jazz great Boney James, too. That's right after this, here on First Coast Connect.
The Jacksonville Symphony presents a world premiere April 4th with a piece by Mary Carr Patton composer-in-residence Courtney Bryan. The Symphony in 60 concert begins at 6:30 and every attendee is invited to the happy hour. This is a truly rare occasion. Information and tickets are at jacksymphony.org.
Vistar Credit Union, committed to offering its members home mortgage options that fit their life. Vistar, we never forget that it's your money. Information available at 777-6000 or vistarcu.org.
A Canadian researcher found a detail that may help to complete family histories for some African Americans.
And I remember sitting in a classroom thinking, but the answer's right there. It's literally right there on people's faces.
Records show that during the slave trade, some Africans came to America with facial markings that told where they were born. Scars reveal some lost family histories on the world. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
In Wise County, Virginia, the opioid rates run high. And solving this crisis?
I've said it over and over, we can't arrest our way out of this. It's just not going to happen. We just put a Band-Aid on it. That's it.
I'm Molly Wood, exploring the drug crisis in Wise County through one man's career. That story next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Why would a doctor terminate a woman's pregnancy close to her due date? The reasons for late-term abortions can involve medical risk to the fetus or the mother. Still, there's plenty of misinformation out there, and some states are debating bills that target the procedure. The reality of late-term abortions. Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Yeah, welcome back. That's Jesuit great Boney James. If you're a fan, listen up. Boney James plays the Florida Theater this Friday. The multi-platinum selling saxophonist has sort of an R&B style that sets him apart. I talked to Boney about his new album, Honestly.
Well, I was really excited when I turned the record in. It came out in September of 2017, but I've had four instrumental singles and two R&B crossover singles so far. So the record has just got legs, like they say in my business, and we're on like the third leg of this tour and coming to Jacksonville, the Florida Theater, and really excited to come back there.
That's Boney James this Friday night at the Florida Theater. Get your tickets at floridatheater.com. And finally, this hour, lots going on all around the town this weekend.
Two, one.
Hey! Carrie Speckman, a.k.a. The Spectator, is here with her top five picks for your weekend, plus ticket giveaway. Hey,
I know.
Good morning to you.
Good morning to you, ma'am.
All right, Boney James coming in. He didn't make your top five, so we just kind of slid him in there to kick things off.
It was really hard to only pick five things.
It's tough. There's a lot happening.
A lot going on.
Okay, let's begin with number five.
I don't know why I laugh every time. It's just funny.
You have to fully commit to this, Spectator.
Oh, I'm committed. Okay. Number five, Jacksonville Backyard Barbecue Championships.
That's a big one.
Yes. They have 30 or 40.
Dozens of barbecuers will be out there competing.
They're professional and amateurs.
Yeah. And it's a certified event,
yes.
I believe. Yeah.
Yes. And people can get samples and taste, and I think they have beer and
Now, this is a fundraiser for Daniel, which is a nonprofit for kids.
Yes.
This is over by the stadium in the Talleyrand Tailgaters area,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay.
That's where it is. It's noon to five.
Okay, so that's number five. Get out and enjoy some barbecue. It's the Jacksonville Barbecue Championships this Saturday. Number four. Okay, this is the big one that we have a ticket giveaway for.
It's opening night. Disney on Ice.
It's
Dare to Dream.
It's Dare to Dream. Okay, this is exciting.
It's a brand new show. It's featuring five heroines from the Disney world, Elsa, Rapunzel, Belle, Cinderella, and Moana, which, side note, this is her first Disney on Ice, Moana.
Oh, she's Moana's big time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so If you've got young children out there and you want a pair of tickets to Disney on Ice.
Four.
Carrie has four pairs of tickets.
No, four tickets.
Oh, I'm sorry. Two pairs of tickets to the opening night of Disney on
which
Ice Dare to
tonight.
Dream, which kicks off tonight. Seven shows running through Sunday. Lots of times to go see it. If you want a pair of tickets to Disney on Ice Dare to Dream, email us right now at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We will pick two winners at random. You will pick up your tickets at our front desk.
That is correct. And again, the tickets are for tonight only.
Oh, they're for tonight only.
It's opening
night. Thank you. Oh, okay. I misspoke there.
Yes.
Okay. Get those emails in. Okay. Let's go to number three.
The world premiere of 10 Bridges. My radio voice?
Yes.
My radio voice.
Okay, what's 10 Bridges?
Well, the symphony has, I didn't even know this till yesterday, has a composer in residence. Her name is Courtney Bryan.
Okay.
And she composed a piece called 10 Bridges, which is inspired by Jacksonville. And she
is going
to premiere it tonight.
A local new music piece.
Yes.
That's
and
very
then
cool.
For the other shows that they're doing, Rachmaninoff Symphony number 2 for the rest of the weekend, they will start out with 10 Bridges.
So that's
premiering tonight.
That's tonight at the Symphony. Number 2. Ooh, Spring in the Blues.
Spring in the Blues is back. I believe it's the largest outdoor blues festival
in America.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it is at the Seawalk Pavilion in Jacks Beach. It's 3 days of music. And they also have a food court and artisans and kids area.
Yeah, the whole thing is Spring in the Blues this Saturday, Friday
and
through Sunday,
free.
And it's free. And last but not least,
dun, 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 dun.
Here's Carrie's number one.
The Jacksonville Shrimp season opener.
It's tonight at the baseball grounds.
It is. They're playing the Jackson Generals. And before, to celebrate, they're having a street carnival.
Oh, very nice.
The stadium. And they'll have vendors, games, face painting, and a performance by the Navy Band Southeast.
Even some fireworks.
Yes, fireworks. And then they're here for 4 days. 4 days in a row. A 4-day homestand, as they say in the business.
All right, there you go. That's Carrie's number one. Get on out to opening day at the ballpark. That's tonight. Can you believe it's that time of year again?
No, I cannot.
Go to thespectator.com for some more ideas if you missed something there. And as always, great to see you.
Always a pleasure, ma'am, and an inconvenience.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corbin is our director. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. 1A is up next. Tomorrow, all the biggest news of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. That's tomorrow. Have a great day, everybody.
Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back. Let me root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. For it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the old ball game. Katie, Katie saw all the game. Knew the players by their first name. Told the umpire he was wrong all along. Good and strong.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.